the things we deal with in our factories, like drugs and alcohol, physical and sexual abuse, like it's for real, man. Like when people walk in these doors, it's their sanctuary. I wish I could share some of the stories, but you know, I can't. But you can just imagine. We've lost employees to suicide. We've had employees that have had children, sisters, brothers, drug overdose, multiple. The communities of America have been abandoned, and people are looking for hope, and they turn to substance abuse, drugs and alcohol. And when they don't have an outlet, they take it out on each other. I think you've seen in our little microcosm in Farmington, Maine, the change that has taken place, because I do believe that Origin has been the instrument of healing of a community.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually you could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
How much do you think about where your clothing comes from? How much do you think about the supply chain here in the United States? How much have you ever thought about how much of our production capacity and capability that we have outsourced overseas? According to Statista, in recent years, China accounted for over 41% of the world textile exports. And according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in the United States, over the last 25 years, apparel had the largest decrease among all manufacturing industries, with a decrease of 85%. Over that period, employment in textile mills decreased 76%. Think about that from the perspective of economic opportunity. It's a trillion-dollar industry. Clothing and textiles account for about 2% of our global GDP. Beyond the lost potential economic opportunities, there are significant additional ethical concerns about outsourcing to countries with extremely lax laws and oversight when it comes to safe working conditions, fair wages, and environmental protection. My guest today is Pete Roberts. He is the co-founder and CEO of Origin USA, and he is on a mission to bring that supply chain back to America. He's also a third-degree Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, and since 2014, Origin has woven its own fabric from raw cotton grown in the United States. Co-founded by Jocko Willink, today Origin makes apparel especially for jiu-jitsu, the outdoors, training, and more. I think what is fascinating about you, though, and what you guys are doing is it started with you trying to fix a need that you identified for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about your background. How'd you get into jiu-jitsu? Sure. Where did you end up? And where did you have this idea that I can make a better gi?
Yeah. So I got into jiu-jitsu in 2006. And after I had dropped out of college, started my first business, young family, looking for something. I thought I wanted to be a fighter like everybody. I wanted to fight MMA. I found this little jiu-jitsu school, and this little like geek, 150-pound nerd choked me out cold. And I didn't know what happened. I was like this big, jacked Division I football player. I was like, nah, can't be. And then he did it again. And I became addicted. It was the first 30 minutes of training jiu-jitsu. I was addicted. And after the recession, 2008, 2009, you know, we, as a young entrepreneur, I didn't have the skill or knowledge on how to pivot and keep the business going. And we ended up getting to a really bad position. At that time, what was deep into a line of credit, which was $20,000, that was deep. And $20,000 could have been $20 million back then. You know, I grew up very middle class, more so more so probably lower class. My mom was on welfare a bit as when we were kids, you know, government cheese in the house and all that stuff. So, you know, as I was going through high school, I watched all the mills and factories shut down around me. I would go into the paper on the weekends to look at, you know, this week's athletic accolades, you know, like, oh, I scored touchdowns or scored. And every time I'd pass over another mill shutting down. And I always thought like, oh, my friend's parents worked at that mill. My buddy's parents worked at that mill. It was the paper mills. It was the shirt factories and ultimately the death of the shoe factories, Bass Shoe here locally. Employed hundreds, thousands of people. And it didn't stick. I just remember feeling the sense of like loss, you know, like I wonder what people are going to do. But I was growing up pretty raw, so it didn't affect me anyway, but I knew it affected my friends. And so when the recession hit in 2008, 2009, and I didn't have the tools to pivot, I ended up having to like basically shut everything down. And I was running a little media company. And the one thing I had was jiu-jitsu. I had jiu-jitsu. I was about 3 years into it. It was my passion. It was all I thought about. It's all I wanted to do. And I was competing, you know, in all the major tournaments. And it's really what kept me going through that recession. You know, I sold everything off, my wife and I, except for our home. I remember promising her when we were first married, like, hey, you'll always have a home. You'll always have a roof over your head. I'll never let you lose that. And we've been together since we were 16. So we were kids together. We've done great things together. We've lost everything together. We've built something else together. So, you know, she's my ride or die for sure. And I remember I came close to losing our home during that recession. But jiu-jitsu and the philosophies of jiu-jitsu and the ethos of jiu-jitsu that was really woven into my DNA at that point, I fell back on it. I fell back on what I knew. You know, there's timing in life. There's timing for everything. There's leverage in life. There's angles in life. There's a mindset when you're on bottom and getting smothered of resetting your mind to be able to move and advance to escape. And I just took that knowledge of jiu-jitsu and I applied it to life. And Origin was born during that time, which was, you know, one of the worst periods of our life, not health-wise, just chaos financially, not knowing our direction in life. So Origin was born in that time. And the first thing I did was look for manufacturing, knowing Maine and New England was a real hub of manufacturing, that the best manufacturing was from New England, that as the Industrial Revolution started and really took off, it was here in New England and on the East Coast that really was the springboard to industrialization in America. Knowing that during the Civil War, the North, you know, was weaving the textiles needed to support the Union Army, knowing that the ships were being built from timber on lands behind my house. So there was this real industrialization, and I live in this little town called Industry, population 700 people, but it used to be a mill on the banks of a lake where they used to float the logs and saw them up and, you know, and turn them into product. So this Yankee ingenuity, I guess you could call it, but this really work ethic that I grew up with, I just couldn't believe there's no manufacturing left, like nothing. And I looked and I made phone calls and I pushed. And I remember the nail in the coffin when I first started Origin for manufacturing in America was, yes, we can weave that fabric for you. Your first order needs to be 500,000 yards. And I was like,
I don't know anything about fabric, but that sounds like a lot.
Yeah. I mean, at $5 or $6 a yard or $10 a yard, I mean, $3 to $5 million. I didn't have, you know, two nickels to rub together, a bucket to piss in at that point, because we had just come out of the recession, didn't have any money. And I was just trying to get this thing going. So we did what everybody else does. I started importing from Pakistan. and that was 2011. I like to say Origin didn't really start until 2012, 2013, because that's when we decided to make shit in America. But 2011 is when this thing was born.
You ready for a wild statistic that I bet you anecdotally already know and felt because of what you're talking about, trying to find manufacturing in the U.S.?
Yeah.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in the United States, over the last 25 years, apparel had the largest decrease among all manufacturing industries, with a decrease of 85%. Over that same period, employment in textile mills decreased 76%. All overseas, all offshore.
Kip Foulkes, a friend of mine and partner, told me that the greatest transfer of wealth in human history flowed out of America and into China the last 30 years.
Why? Why did those people, the people who were at the levers of making those choices, do that?
Well, it's a complex equation in which there's a few variables and powers at play. One is the federal government. One is the corporate raiders, but the ultimate adversary is greed. Greed drove our factories to shut down, our machinery overseas, and the export of the jobs. And if you remember Ross Perot saying, you're going to hear a giant sucking sound of our jobs going south. That was just the beginning. It wasn't really a giant sucking sound. I'd like to say it was a slow drip of our jobs. It was just enough so you didn't notice. One mill here, one mill there, this location, that location, news article. It wasn't like it all shut down. It was very slow. But
well, you didn't notice if you were the consumer. You certainly noticed if it was your mill that shut down.
Yeah. If your town was affected, you noticed. But people were so concerned with surviving. Like, what were they going to come together and go to war to keep it open? Like, that's just not feasible when you're going against the giant of Wall Street, this corporate giant. But you know, when it started kind of with NAFTA and then GATT, but the World Trade Organization played a big role in that. America used to have quotas. So after World War II, you know, we would apply quotas to different countries that could import stuff into America. And there were, you know, you can bring in 20,000 of these, you can bring in 100,000 of these, and it kept the American economy strong and our middle class expanded, you know. And what makes America beautiful and unique and work is the middle class. Without the middle class, you simply have, you know, you're back to where we were 250 years, 300 years ago. You have the peasants and the aristocracy. So, you know, and knowing after World War II, that you had the Cold War going on and communism was hot and heavy, the topic of communism, of course, in Germany and, you know, East Berlin and West Berlin, the wall went up almost overnight. But China was strong on the scene. And I believe that in an effort to control China, America sold ourselves out. That if our economy could supply the means of production for China, then we could control them. And I think that that's exactly what happened. And now we're discovering how we've armed them with ordnance in the form of production, where they're going to become the strongest nation the world has ever seen. And knowing that they like to look at the future in the form of a dynasty, they're thinking 1,000 years out, and we can't even get out of our own way and put this freaking damn phone down. So we're at a pivotal point in history. And there's a lot more to it than what I just shared, but that's like just skimming the surface.
Well, I got another stat talking about the volume of production in China and how they pivoted. In 2022, just 2022, China produced just over 23.24 billion pieces of clothes with a B. That's a lot.
That's fast fashion. That's fashion for you.
That's like all probably all fashion. I don't know the size of the fashion market, but that's a really big number. I tell you what, I think what gives me hope, though, when it comes to looking at China, I agree with you. They look at things from their perception of time is vastly different. But I think they had an oversight when it came to their one child only policy, because that's going to come. The snake is going to bite the tail on that one. And I listened to some smart people talking about what they're probably going through right now. They may not be reporting actual correct numbers when it comes to population, but they have a serious problem on their hands, which hopefully people in this country could realize while they're dealing with that, maybe we could recover a little bit of what we pushed overseas.
Yeah, I think that might be a way to give us a new jump start. But if we don't shock this thing back into action, you know, that little blip on the radar, they'll figure out a way out of it. And I say that because, you know, there's some machines that aren't made here anymore. We have a laser cutter, and it was made in China. And it's a specialty machine that you couldn't buy anywhere else. We had a kid come over and install this thing. This is years ago. And he goes through a sequence, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And he's done this all over the world. This is his job. He knows it inside and out. When he was installing this machine, he hit like a bug. And so he went through his other sequence of things. He's conditioned to do this. Boom, 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 ah, boom, boom, boom. John, my first employee, John Mylan, he went downstairs to see how everything was coming, and the kid was sitting in the corner with his head between his legs and arms, crying and rocking like this, just rocking. And John's like, "Hey, man, what's wrong?" He's like, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I did everything I was supposed to do. I did everything perfectly. I did everything in order, and I don't know what's wrong." And he couldn't think outside the box. He wasn't a free thinker to think, "I should call somebody." And John's like, "Hey, why don't you shut the computer down and turn it back on?"
That's what I'm talking about. That's my strategy for electronics.
Shut it down. Shut it down. Turn it back on. Everything's fine. But the fact that like millions of people in this culture and economy are raised to be part of the machine, and in America, we're raised to be free thinkers and to go against the grain. That's two extremes, and it's the extremes of communism and it's the extremes of freedom. And I don't say communism and capitalism, because those aren't the things that butt heads. It's communism and it's freedom. Those are the two things that butt heads. Freedom is, I have individuality. I can be who I want. I can do what I want. I can be where I want. I can do the things I want to do in life. You know, and if I make a mistake, I can always restart. Where the ideals of communism, outside of the obvious, you know, no rights of inheritance, no personal property, and the government controls the people and the means of production and provides equality and equity across their population, that's a whole different mindset. They're gonna tell you what you do and where you plug in. And hundreds of years of that creates a certain type of person in a way they think, you know, groupthink. And over here in America, we're trusting that we're smart enough because we're independent thinkers and we're free thinkers that we're better than this. And that's what makes me nervous. If we don't turn that shit on now, it's going to be a big problem. And that's why Origin exists. It's the wave of freedom, you know, and our mission statement is to breathe life back into the dream. So trying to rekindle that American dream, man, that bruised and battered American dream.
So in 2012, you're saying in your mind, Origin was really born because you made that decision to American or bust.
Yeah.
What kind of things did you start discovering? Because, you know, kind of, I guess, early on when we first hit record, you're talking about seeing, you know, or being able to talk about slavery, rivers running black, working conditions, and a variety of other things. And I feel like you probably were thrown up against that optic pretty quickly once you started looking at what it would take to bring jobs back to the U.S.
Yeah, you know, I did. I I felt so, I was just so pissed off, man. I remember our manufacturer in Pakistan. I remember seeing another garment being used by a person at an international jiu-jitsu competition and thinking like, oh, there's an origin garment, there's a gi. And as they walked by, there was a different logo on the back. And I was just, I felt so burned, man. Yeah. And I was getting ready to compete against Shanji Hibero, 7-time world champ. Like that was, that happened like just before my match with him.
So what you're describing though, is what I have heard from so many people. They will outsource a design to Pakistan. And oftentimes before they even get the physical product, they can go on other people's websites and they see the exact same design that has already been repurposed and rebranded.
It's horrible. There's no, they don't care. Whether it's China or Pakistan or anywhere else, there's no consideration for intellectual property. They're savage. They're going to do what they need to do. And like I said, Ali on the Skype call with me back then in 2012, when I called him out on it, before we started building the factory, the first factory, I said, man, I said, what are you doing? I said, you're literally taking the things I'm designing and you're selling it to other brands. And he's like, hey, in his accent, he's like, hey, business is business. We're going to do what we're going to do. You can't do anything about it. And that was the words I needed to hear to start cutting down trees and sawing out timbers and building a factory.
Whew. That is a bespoke taste. Good morning, everybody. Today's episode of Change Agents is brought to you by HVMN. Specifically, their product, Ketone IQ. What is Ketone IQ, you might ask yourself? It is a brain fuel. It's something that I use, like I just did. I'm getting ready to sit down for a day of podcasting, and I want clarity of focus. I want a little bit of a push when it comes to my mental acuity and ability, but I don't want to over-caffeinate myself because this isn't caffeine. These are ketones. And before I even get into what ketones are, I'm actually going to let you do that yourself. Research to your heart's desire. But if you're looking for a clean energy source that has substantially helped me without the post-caffeine crash, I cannot recommend Ketone IQ enough. Again, it's from a company called HVMN. What does that actually stand for? Health via modern nutrition is the answer to that. You can find Ketone IQ at HVMN.com. And if you use the promo code Andy at checkout, you are going to get 20% off. That is HVMN.com. Promo code Andy. One last note. Have a chaser. It's a bespoke flavor experience. It's not that it's bad, but it's not that it's good either. I don't drink it for the taste. I drink it for the effect. Talk to me about the journey from sawing down those first trees. I've heard you personally tell the story of the first building that you built, but I think it's a story worth hearing again. And talk to me about when you started seeing behind the curtain of the actual environmental cost, physical cost, economic cost of what actually is occurring in this outsourced overseas production.
You know, when I decided we were going to build a factory, I didn't know anything about sewing machines or factories. I just knew that New England started by people cutting down trees. You know, they hit Plymouth Rock, they cut down some trees, and they built a little village.
It's very dense. Very, very dense.
Yeah. It's just so dense. So, so naive, man. Yeah, so naive.
I'm not don't the walk smartest. Into the woods. You will not come back out.
I'm not the smartest knife in the drawer. You know what I mean? I'm an ADHD INFJ who got C's and D's in high school. So, I'm not one of these super book smart people. And I don't like authority either. So I don't like people telling me what I can't do. I've been able to harness all of that as a superpower. It's not kryptonite. It's a superpower for sure. But it started with me calling my buddy Tim Couch and saying, hey man, Can you bring your chainsaw over? I marked out some trees. I want to take them down. We're going to build a factory. Then my father-in-law, I called him and said, hey, can you bring your chipper over? We need to chip some trees and bring your chainsaw too. And I just got my friends together and we just started leveling. I just taped it out with, you know, caution ribbon and we just leveled it. Didn't go to the town to get permission, you know, didn't get a building permit. It was a literal crime of passion. You know, we brought the sand in. It's crazy. We had a bunch of Eastern white pine logs sawn out into 10 by 10, 27 foot long timbers. And we put some concrete down and we just built this like an old school barn raise. And we just built this structure. And we spent the next, you know, 4, 5, 6 months, you know, 16 hour days just building it and putting it together. My brother, my father-in-law, my friends, all my jiu-jitsu friends. It was just all my jiu-jitsu buddies that trained with me that just helped me build this thing. We didn't have contractors. I didn't have money for contractors. It's just us. And I remember we built it and we didn't have any power. And so I started up a generator and I found an old machine from L.L. Bean from the 50s, and this guy refurbished it. And I dropped it in the middle and we just started sewing stuff. I didn't know you needed three-phase power. I'm out in the middle of the freaking woods. I don't know what three-phase power is. So, you know, white belt moves, black belt passion.
That's a dangerous spot to be.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I'm thankful for the tuition payments that we made along the way. It allowed us, not knowing and not having any knowledge left. I traveled all around New England. I would just show up at a place that used to sew or was on there, you know, kind of hanging on by a thread, and ask them if they had any old sewing machines or any old machinery. And they would sell me something for $50, $75, $100. And I just loaded into my old red Chevy and it would drive down the road with the back end, you know, an inch off the ground and the front end lifted up because the shit was so heavy, and I'd drive it back and I'd unload it. I didn't know what it did. I just knew we needed equipment and we started to figure it out, but it was really, really hard. You know, like I can't capture the difficulties of what we did in a conversation. I can only kind of give you the results, which is the first week we announced we're making gis in America. And I put a YouTube video out, and it's still on YouTube. Hey, this is the Origin Factory. We're going to make jiu-jitsu gis in America. That first week we made 5 pairs of pants. And I remember calling Tadeco, my business partner and co-founder, being like, hey, Tadek, we made 5 pairs of pants this week. I think each pair of pants cost like $200 each to make. You know, I mean, it just a real naive crime of passion. I didn't think through how we're going to get ghee material, you know. So when it came right down to it, we built this factory and you couldn't buy ghee material, so I had to then import the ghee material for the jackets. And I was like, what are we doing here? Like, what are we really doing? And it came to a point where I had put us in such a difficult situation with reckless ambition that I didn't know what to do. I remember driving down the Tadecos and being like, I don't know what to do. Like, I put us in this shit situation. And I met an old guy who had built this big business. His name is John. And he said, I'm willing to have a conversation with you. Don't ever ask me for anything. Don't ask me to introduce you to anybody. And I said, yeah, no factor. I'm just looking for some help. And I said, I'm a young, hungry entrepreneur and I want to win. And he said, okay, meet me at my lake house. And my father-in-law brought me down because they were friends. And the first thing he said to me is, he said, hey, I'm going to tell you something. And if you're good with this, we can continue talking. And I said, I'm good. He goes, you're not special. Your ideas aren't special. And nobody gives a shit. I said, okay. And then he went on to tell me about how there's great ideas in the world, and it has nothing to do with great ideas. It has to do with the person who's willing to go all in. And he's like, what's your problem? And I said, well, I don't have the capital. He's like, I don't want to hear about capital. He goes, capital is a tiny sliver of the pie. Go remortgage your house. You need capital, go remortgage your house. You believe in what you're doing? I said, yeah, 100%, 100% do. He's like, go remortgage your house. There's a lot of business units and strategy in building a company, and capital is a sliver. It's just one component. And I remember leaving that meeting and I went and remortgaged my house, you know, and man, I think we finally paid off that second mortgage like last year. So it was only $100,000. You know what I mean? Like it was only $100,000, but again, it's all relative. It's $100,000 back then is $10 million. It's everything. It's everything.
What'd you do with it? Invested.
Yeah. I mean, we, first of all, when I signed the paperwork on that 100 grand, it's almost like I was immediately awake. I was awake. I don't know how to explain it. The feeling, my mind opened up and I just knew what had to be done. You know, we ended up buying some machinery, hiring some people, getting some patterns made. And there was a really important pivotal moment where we discovered an old loom. And it was the one component that really kept us from being truly 100% made in America without compromise was weaving our own fabric. I had known that Maine used to weave fabric. You know, I mean, you have New England. New England was like the fabric capital of America. You know, New Hampshire had Amoskeg Mills in Manchester, and Maine had Bates Mills in Lewiston. And I was talking with the guy who sold me that first sewing machine, and I was sitting in his office, and he's already passed his career. He's been around, you know, doing this for 50 years. So he's seen the rise and the fall of industry. And he had an old factory filled with sewing machines. He said, this is only 5% of what I had. The rest of them I sent to scrap. You know, I had them recycled and got the money for the steel. And I said to him, hey, honestly, we're really missing one thing. And this is a long shot. I said, but you know anybody that might have a loom? And he looked at me and he goes, get in my truck. And I went outside, got in his little Ford Ranger. We drove two blocks up. We entered this massive million square foot old mill, and we walked in, and there was this old woman, Rachel DeGrossiers. And he said, hey, Rachel, this is Pete. Pete's looking for a loom. And she smiled and she said, really, what are you trying to do? And I said, we're trying to weave fabric. And she's like, well, this is a museum. You know, this is where we used to weave fabric. We've kept some stuff to put this museum together, but nobody weaves fabric anymore. But she said, fill out this paper and follow me. And it was a little like release, basically saying, we're going to go into an abandoned part of the mill. You could fall through the floor or have the roof cave in on you. And she, you know, she took me up into old Bates Mill number 5 across this gangway, which is basically rotted out, into this mill, boards buckled and rotten. And there was, in the middle of the floor, it was one loom about 100 yards out, one loom in the middle of the floor. And it was just a frame. It was like walking through the woods in New England and seeing a tree grow up through an old 1930s Chevy that's all rusted out and it's only half there. That's what this was. It was this loom frame in the middle of this floor. Man, I thought I had struck gold. I was like, this is a loom. This is our destiny. And we walked over to it and I said, I'd love to buy this from you. She's like, well, I have it set aside for the museum. When we sold to China, the rest of the looms all went to China. They came in, they cleared everything out. But because this one wasn't really running, I kept it here. And it was covered in lanolin, which is wool oil. And so it was preserved. I mean, it was rusty, the parts that weren't preserved, but there was this coating of just old oil on it. And I said, I'd love to buy it. I don't have money, but if you're willing to sell it to me, I'll make this work again. I'll find a way. And I think I bought it for $2,000 or $3,000. Again, crime of passion. I called the moving company and they told me it was going to be $20,000 to move it out of there. Now, what am I getting myself into? So I called the same group of guys to come. I think it took 8 guys, 9 hours to move it from the middle of the floor to the edge of the floor. That's how buckled and broken this floor was. And it was 9,000 pounds, this loom. And we grabbed it and we slung it out and we put it on a flatbed and we headed back to the woods of Maine. And I did find an old timer, Lenny, who passed away 2 years ago, who worked with us over 5 or 6 years and passed all of his knowledge on to myself and then our young team here at Origin on how to weave fabric. And man, without that knowledge being passed on, it would be gone forever. And a lot of America's supply chain is like that. It's on the fringe of being gone forever. And if we don't keep the knowledge, we'll never get it back. It'll be very, very hard to get back. So we got to be savages about it. But Lenny helped us bring it back to life. And we started weaving fabric and we started making gi material and we started making gis. And we became the best jiu-jitsu gi manufacturers over the course of about 6 or 7 years. And that's all we made. We just made jiu-jitsu gis. Year one, I think we did $300,000. I think our enterprise now, the whole enterprise, I think we're going to do about $150 million this year. So
why should people care where their genes come from?
Because genes is the thing that unites us all, whatever side of the aisle you're on. You know, we can fight about a lot of things, but the feeling that genes give you, that independence, the feeling of freedom.
How about even broader? Broader. Why should people care that what they're wearing head to toe? Because you guys are actually at the point now where you could go head to toe. Why should people care though? Why should they take that additional time and sometimes additional cost and reinvest it back into what you're doing versus just the, I'll just go to Target or Walmart or wherever the hell people shop these days and get their stuff?
Yeah, you're either building towards your future and the future of your community and the future of your country, or you're selling it away through your purchase. When you buy something, you're selling your future away if it's not made in America, or you're building your future, your kids, your grandkids, your communities, your supply chains. Literally buying something that's not made in America is contributing to freaking dead rivers, slave labor, and exporting the wealth that made America what it is, allowed us to have the innovations in science and technology and infrastructure. You're literally selling it away drip by drip. So it's important, man. Like, it's important that you know where shit comes from. And I think people are really starting to wake up and check the tag. You know, I want to run a check the tag campaign, but I think we have a moral obligation that if we believe in the foundation, what this country was founded on, to try and save it. And instead of just trying to survive, that we find a way to thrive. And that's going to take everybody from both sides, from everywhere, from freaking Farmington, Maine to San Diego, California, coast to coast, to come together and recognize what's happened, recognize everyone's responsible. Both sides of the aisle were responsible for NAFTA and GATT. It wasn't the Democrats and the Republicans. It was all the people, all the greed, all the backroom deals. And not until the people come together can we show the power of change. And I think through denim, I think through clothing, I think through the things we wear, because it's something, you put something on your body every day, so it's in front of you every day. I think that's the way to do it.
I like this idea of a check the tag campaign. It gives you the chance to explain to people the difference between the price and the cost. You know?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah. Do you want to, I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that working conditions in the origin factories might be a little bit improved over other factories that people may find, that you guys probably don't have to invest in anti-suicide nets on the higher floors of your buildings. You don't have to. Well, you are probably more concerned about the environmental impact. I watched a video the other day you put out. I think you were in the main factory, but you were talking about giving people a two-hour raise, a $2 an hour raise.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, if you just go shopping and you only look at the tag for what the price is, the cost can be lost on you. What do you want to invest in? I would rather invest in an organization that cares about people, that cares about this country, that cares more about the environment and the impact that their products have socially and environmentally, than save $2 on an item.
Yeah. It's got to be equitable. If there's going to be an ask to spend two, there's got to be a way to spend two. So if you're going to spend a dollar more, you've got to be able to make a dollar more. But there's also the choice to not spend on frivolous shit so that you can make that investment. I'm going to go a little bit. I'm going to take it a little bit different direction, Andy, because the people of America have been abandoned. The things we deal with in our factories, like drugs and alcohol, physical and sexual abuse, like, it's for real, man. Like, when people walk in these doors, it's their sanctuary. I wish I could share some of the stories, but, you know, I can't. But you can just imagine. We've lost employees to suicide. We've had employees that have had children, sisters, brothers, drug overdose, multiple. The communities of America have been abandoned, and people are looking for hope, and they turn to substance abuse, drugs and alcohol. And when they don't have an outlet, they take it out on each other. I think you've seen in our little microcosm in Farmington, Maine, the change that has taken place, because I do believe that Origin has been the instrument of healing of a community. And yeah, we still deal with issues here and there, but there's purpose when people walk in the doors. And I've had many, many, many employees say, I can't wait to get back to work tomorrow because it's the only place I find fulfillment in my life. Now, that's a real shitty place to be. So allowing people to see an upward trajectory, in life, and to be able to be part of providing that so they can change their station or change their class level, so they can buy oil for the winter, so they can put a down payment on a home. Like, these are important things that the broken communities of America need. We can never come together as a country if you're just thinking about surviving. So there's a job to do, and it took 30 years to extract the soul from America. And it's going to take decades to inject it back in. It isn't an overnight thing. It's not going to happen overnight.
Are you hopeful that people are paying attention?
I know they're paying attention. Not just people. And the goal is to tell 90 million people. Like, Origin has an impact when 90 million people know. This has been the mission for 5 years, and the reason we've been working on this documentary with my partner and executive producer, Steve Best, who spent the last 18 months in Europe chasing stories. But 90 million people need to know, and that will have an impact. I know that the big brands are paying attention, because I've had Levi's call me and ask me if we could make product for them. And I said, why don't you make it yourself? We don't know how to.
Wow.
It's been 25 years since we made product in America. We don't know how to. I had Adidas call me to make product. I mean, we rejected all of them. You know, like, hey, listen, you abandoned the American worker, and we're scrappy and we're small, but watch your back, because we're going to choke your asses out. So we've got a plan to speak to the masses, to create an awareness campaign for them to pay attention that will allow them to come together and drive change. So yeah, people are paying attention, but we need a lot more to pay attention.
I hope people have the attention span to follow the dots on that one. I don't think most people realize the danger. And I think you highlighted it well about what happened during COVID when you have the realization that almost everything you rely upon in your life is actually outsourced from somewhere else, and they could turn that shit off like a light switch. Not a good space to be at all.
Not a good space to be. You know, I go in between the factories from Maine to North Carolina in a Cirrus. And I know you're a pilot and you used to fly Cirrus. And I sit up there thinking about how that, even though this is made in America, I think Duluth, Minnesota, if I'm not right, it's owned by a Chinese company. And they probably have the codes to shut it off.
Oh, yes. 100%.
That makes me real nervous. So when you're 30,000 feet in the air, you know you can be shut off. That's a scary place to be. That is not being in control of your destiny.
You know, that's an interesting example that you use, because I had forgotten about that. I did a delivery, a pickup, or what would it be? It was produced, and I went out to the Duluth factory and picked it up there and flew it back to San Diego. There are so many entities like that in the U.S. that can talk about, you know, and I don't think all, I'm assuming all the parts in the Cirrus are not made in the U.S., but it certainly is assembled in the U.S. I don't know where they actually make the Vision jet, though. That might be at one of their other factories. I know they make the SR-22s up there. But how many companies out there have that American face to it? But if you get a layer or two deep into the onion, it's rapidly back overseas.
Yeah, China doesn't just own the means of production. They own the companies and they own the land.
Yeah. Yeah, they're digging into architecture these days. They're digging, or agriculture, I should say, probably architecture as well, real estate. There's a lot of stuff that is going on a layer or two deep that people need to stop and take a breath and dig into a little bit, I think, at least.
One of the things Jocko, I know you're very friendly with Jocko, and he might have been the one that introduced us originally, but also one of my business partners says it's an economic war on freedom.
Yeah.
It's an economic war on freedom against China.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you hopeful we can win?
I know we can win. I was sitting on a plane a couple of years ago. And there was this professor. I'm sitting next to this gentleman, and he was reading a book about China and how they've won. I don't remember the name of the book. And we started to have a little small talk about things. And I went into what we were doing and how we were doing it. And he was just like, this is impossible. This is impossible to do this. How the heck are you guys able to do that? Well, that's the power of the American spirit. Yeah, it's possible. Impossible missions is all we've ever done. That's all we've ever done. I mean, take it right back. You know, take it right back. Take it right back to Paul Revere saying the British are coming and their massive ships. They were like the Abrams tank of the days, and we're running around without any boots on.
So, like, there's so East Coast of you to pick that example.
It is, man. It is. You know, I was born in Gloucester, Massachusetts, man.
Like, and I was like, wow, you really picked an example there that was quite close to home. I wonder where you got that one from.
I did. You know, that's the essence of who we are. We're fighters. You know, I think we've gotten soft as baby shit at times, but we're fighters at heart, and we've seen sparks of that come together in times of need, you know, whether it's World War One or World War Two or the Vietnam War or the War of Freedom. Like, we know how to come together when we want to. And I think it's that spirit and the way that we're raised as Americans when we're told, hey, you can be anything in life you want to be. You can do anything you want to do. Like, I believed that shit as a naive kid. I was like, yeah, I can. Friggin' right. I like that. I can get C's and D's and I can still do whatever I want to do. So I think it's going to take a little bit more to drive people over the edge to be able to come together. But absolutely, we can win. And it's going to start with taking the means of production back. Going to start with that at scale, not just in our industry, clothing, apparel, outdoor, but in all industries.
If you're interested in what you heard today and you want to support American manufacturing, you can learn more about Origin at originusa.com. That is originusa.com. And you can also check out their YouTube channel, Origin USA.